This episode of Behind the Video is brought to you by the Independent Media Network. The Independent Media Network helps journalists and content creators create their own jobs by building sustainable online businesses. If you're an unemployed or underemployed journalist or content creator, visit imnct.com for more information.
Hey everybody, welcome back to episode, I think this is number 62 of Behind the Video, and joining me as always is my lovely and talented co-host Tim Street. Tim, how you doing?
Doing well, Lon. I hear the baby got you up early this morning.
5 a.m. like every day. So, and it's funny, she's not like crying, she's playing, you know, but she just makes so much noise that you have to get up and see what she's up to. So I think it's a very long road ahead, but it's all right. I go to bed earlier now, so.
There you go. Well, we have a guest this week.
And who is that?
Kai Hassan. How are you, man?
How's it going? Doing very well, thank you.
So, Kai, tell us a little bit about what you do. You got into web video doing a web series, right? And that turned into a company.
Yeah, so I started back in about 2005 experimenting with web video. I was really interested in being a director, and I was told that if you don't pay attention to the internet, then you're crazy. So I started making sort of dabbling in web shows, web content. A good friend of mine wanted to go to Asia and make a web show with me. So we went to Asia and made a travel series called Huge in Asia. We ended up selling that to Lonely Planet, the guidebook. Then we got corporate jobs. I went to Current TV. He went to News Corp. And we sort of we did that for a little while, a year, and then we had enough. And we decided to start a company. At the time, it was 2008. We didn't really know how we were going to make money. We just knew that we wanted to be part of the industry. So we kind of toiled away for about 2 years trying to figure out what we were doing. We were just making YouTube videos. We were trying to work with different clients, making YouTube videos for them, doing whatever we could. 2010, we made a web series called White Collar Brawler, which is a documentary web series that followed me and my friend as we learned how to box. That was kind of a breakthrough for us. At the same time, we made some viral videos that went very big. And when we came out of that, we sort of had taken another step with our company. We started working with bigger and bigger brands who wanted to use our expertise to make videos for themselves on the web. So today, we're a company. It's called Portal A, a company of 15 people. We specialize in branded content. So it can mean a lot of things. It's always for the web. It means one-off videos, viral videos. It means web series. We work with clients like Microsoft and YouTube, Benefit Cosmetics, Sephora, to make, you know, I think really fun, smart content for the web. Typically, that means they're not commercials. They're stuff that on their own, they have to be shareable. People have to want to post them on Facebook. But at the same time, you have to get a message across that the brand has. So it's a challenge. It's really fun. And we feel like we're sort of on the forefront of where content is going.
Very cool. One of the things I want to talk about a little bit later in the show is White Collar Brawler. It's an award-winning series. You guys won a IAWTV award for that series. But I'd also like to chat about, you know, approaching it from an independent content creator standpoint and what's happened with that show since. So we'll get to that in a little bit. Lon, we have some breaking news.
We do have some breaking news, and that is that Blip.tv, which has been a service that I've used for a long time because they initially didn't have any restraints as to upload length and all that other stuff, has been sold, Tim, to Maker Studios. That's a pretty big move there, and I would guess it's probably starting that direction towards having some alternative competitor to YouTube and their current dominance over the web play. So what have you been hearing out there, Tim? Because you've been at a couple parties where I'm sure people have been talking about this week, right?
Me at a party? I can't imagine that. I don't go to parties. What are you talking about?
And let me add something, too. For anyone that's ever been with Tim at a party, Tim just kind of goes into the room, and the whole party just comes. Like, by the time the night is over, everyone has rotated around to bend Tim's ear for a little bit. So he's pretty fun to watch at a party. So what are people saying, though, when they do rotate around the room for you?
Well, you know, there's different things. I mean, a lot of people talk about what a great deal this is and how it, you know, blah, 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 blah. So kind of my spin on it, maybe Kai has a different spin, but what I'm seeing is, you know, Blip's been around a long time. They've had a lot of money invested into Blip, and they haven't really jumped out. Like, people know who YouTube is. They don't know who Blip is. And it hasn't become a destination site on its own. I mean, there are definitely people that have made some money on Blip, different independent content creators, but they haven't blown up. And when you look at Maker Studios, Maker is addicted to YouTube right now. And so for them to create their own platform, they'd have to leverage something that already exists, like Blip, or they'd have to rent something like maybe Bright Cove, or they'd have to build it from scratch. And I guess, you know, with all the money invested in Blip, the investors saw it as a way to get some of their money back. I don't know that they're getting all their money back, but at least they're getting some money out of Blip. So some people say fire sale. Other people say, you know, it's transition. I don't know for sure. I don't know the exact details. I just know party rumor. So it's all conjecture on my part. But from a Maker standpoint, Maker has investments from, I think, like Warner Brothers and different companies, and they need to break away from YouTube. And Blip, from an independent content creator standpoint, Blip's a great platform. I mean, it provides a lot of value. You get a player that is a pretty gorgeous player. You can slap it onto your own website, and it comes with monetization, so the ads are already built in. Which is fantastic. Now, before this purchase, Blip had just changed to where you needed to be approved by Blip in order to use the service, which in the past it was pretty much anybody could be on there as long as you weren't doing spammy type stuff or porn. And that's changing. So as to what happens next for independent content creators, I don't know. Kai, you got any spin on this?
No, I mean, I think you're pretty much right. I think that, you know, the collective buying Meta Cafe is a good, I think they bought it in June, that purchase happened, and there's a lot of parallels. Obviously, Meta Cafe is its own, has its own player, has its own sales team, collective is an MCN. What they've been doing with Meta Cafe, they've been moving some of their partners over to Meta Cafe on their website. So you see Video Game High School by Freddie Wong is using Meta Cafe, Hannah Hart uses some of her videos are on Meta Cafe. If you go to Meta Cafe and you go to their web series, there's a little tab there. It's everyone on there is pretty much a collective partner. So, you know, I think that Meta Cafe might be different than Blip because my understanding is that there's more traffic going to Meta Cafe. So it's possible that, you know, one thing that Collective got out of a purchase of Meta Cafe that you might not get out of a purchase of Blip is that Meta Cafe can now point to the partners of the collective and draw traffic to them, get some new eyes on their content.
That's a really good point.
Yeah, I'm not sure you can do that with Blip because, you know, I feel like Blip has been spinning their wheels for a long time and never has been able to create an audience just for themselves. So I'm not sure if that's there, but, you know, I do think that the sales team, having like a really strong sales team is something that Maker will get out of this sale and they won't have to build it on their own.
Yeah, for sure. Something else to point out in the article that we linked to in the show notes comes from AdAge, and it's a list of top videos. And if you look at the number one on that list, that's a video that you produced, Kai. You want to tell us about it?
Yeah. So I don't know how the list is generated, but the number one video on that list is this Naruto video that I made with Ryan Higa. Basically how it came about was, so we work with, again, a number of different clients. And in this case, the client was YouTube itself. YouTube came to us and say, hey, we're trying to make Geek Week content. We're trying to basically, and what's interesting is they did Comedy Week, right, a month and a half, 2 months ago, whatever it was.
Right.
And one thing they found out was, in Comedy Week, they made hundreds and hundreds of videos, and only the top 1% of videos, you know, got like 75% of the views of all for all of Geek Week. So they decided for all of Comedy Week. So they decided for Geek Week, we're going to invest in fewer videos and we're going to make them much bigger, basically. So they selected some of their partners to make Geek Week content: Quarter Digital, Freddie Wong, Ryan Higa, Felicia Day, etc. they gave them budgets and they went out and made content. And so YouTube came to us and said, hey, can you work with Ryan Higa to make something really cool? And so the turnaround was very fast. They gave us about 3 weeks. We had to fly to Japan, make this insane video with Ryan Higa. It was incredible, really fun. And then we put it up on YouTube, and you know, Ryan is a master. He's actually kind of a genius. Everything he does is smart, thoughtful. He always thinks about quality. We put out this video, and it does extremely well. I think it got the most views for Geek Week. So it was a big success for us.
And that video itself, it's kind of a spoof on what?
Yeah, so for those who know and those who don't really, Naruto is an anime in Japan, very big. It's also pretty big in America because I think it's on the CW. So a lot of younger people watch it. I actually didn't really watch it, but I knew of Naruto. In Japan, it's interesting. In Japan, parody is illegal. You can't make content in Japan that parodies other content. It's seen as a copyright infringement. So there really isn't that many Naruto parodies out there, even though it's such a big franchise. Ryan Higa is a huge, huge fan of Naruto and wanted to do a parody. So we just did it, basically. It's a trailer for a Naruto movie, as if, like, you know, Chris Nolan was making a movie for Naruto. And it's, you know, it's just tongue-in-cheek.
So just to get this straight, it's only illegal to post a parody in Japan. It's not illegal for you to physically go there and make a parody.
Apparently not. There were steps we were taking that I don't think anyone quite understood the law 100%. So there were steps that were being taken to, you know, we weren't allowed to talk about while we were doing it. We weren't really supposed to talk about our client at all, where the money was coming from, et cetera. And once we got out of Japan, everything was cool. So.
And it's one of those gray areas where, you know, you're posting it in the United States where it is legal, and where's the maybe they could pull it off YouTube Japan or something like that. But you know, in kind of looking at some of your work, you know, what was interesting was to see that you had a mayoral campaign on there, and I've worked in politics for a while, and I know how conservative political consultants can be, even the liberal consultants can be, on trying new things, especially humor being used as a campaign vehicle, a message for their campaign vehicles. So can you talk a little bit about how that came about and maybe some of the challenges you had in trying to adapt a political message, which is usually very finely honed to a pretty fun ad?
Yeah. So my company has three partners. One of our partners, Zach, has a history in politics. And so political work is kind of natural to us because we have him. We really get how to do political messaging. And it's been perfect for us. It's been a great way for us to sort of disrupt that industry. Basically, the story behind that video, we were tapped by... The mayor of San Francisco was Gavin Newsom, who became lieutenant governor, so they tapped an interim mayor named Ed Lee. Ed Lee didn't have any enemies because he pledged to not run for re-election after his term was up. He did a really great job because of that. In fact, he did a lot of good work with the tech industry. He gave some tax rebates to Twitter and Zynga, et cetera, and the tech industry loved him. So when his term was up, the tech industry came to him and said, you have to run again. You have to break your pledge and run again. And he said, you know, I don't really want to break my pledge. And they said, no, break your pledge. We will give you support. So we were approached by Sean Parker of social network fame and Ron Conway, who's a huge angel investor in San Francisco. And we're told, hey, can you make a video for Ed Lee? He's going to break his pledge, and we have to reframe this, make it seem like it's a good thing because he's a good mayor. What's wrong with running again? So we came up with this idea. We were told we had MC Hammer at our disposal.
Can you just imagine that discussion? Like,
just by the way.
Everything you want, and you got MC Hammer at your disposal. So.
Exactly. So we were thinking about it, and we're like, oh, my God, it's amazing. Too legit to quit. Ed Lee is too legit to quit. So we made this video. Around the time we made the video, Ed Lee was getting really bad press. People were saying he's a liar, he broke his pledge, all this stuff, and that's how his enemies and adversaries were attacking him. This video came out, And it didn't. If you watch the video, it doesn't really talk about what his politics are. You don't get that sense. And some people came to us and were like, you know, that's the problem with your video. I see it a different way. It's not really the point of the video to tell you anything about his politics. It does two things. One, it gets people to watch it. So people in San Francisco, I mean, they don't actually think about a mayor or a race. They don't really care who's going to be mayor. But they did see this video, and it got on their mind. So that's number one. Number two, this video is an endorsement video. You see a lot of different celebrities endorsing Ed Lee in the video. It gives him a lot of cachet. So the video got about 500,000 views, but the way we did our targeting and our distribution, we made sure that a large percentage of those views came from San Francisco. Anyways, we won the race. I won't credit the video, but it was quite effective. On the day the video released, more people were tweeting about the election. 5 times more people were tweeting about the election on that day than on election day itself. So it was an important video, important for the campaign. Especially, and now we do a lot of political work, and that was our first foray into it. But our other political work, you know, we generally try to be crazy, just like that video.
Right, and I think it is definitely, as you said, ripe for some change, because people generally don't consume political content voluntarily, and in that one at least, yeah, you got 500,000 people watching it. So what was the trick to like geo-targeting some of that viewership? Was it just how you promoted it? Was it hosting the video somewhere else beyond YouTube? What was the key to trying to get a more targeted audience for that?
Yeah, so back when we released that video, YouTube TrueView hadn't come out, I think, or maybe it was just the very beginning. Now, if we release that video, we would use YouTube TrueView pretty heavily, I think. Back then, though, we used sort of a mixture of, we used Facebook for sure. What we did before we launched the video, we tried different thumbnails and different title words, and we tested them for just like $5 and saw which one got the most clicks. And it turned out that a picture of Ed Lee was not getting a lot of clicks, but a picture of Brian Wilson, the Giants, San Francisco Giants pitcher, was getting a lot of clicks, right? So we targeted people who were in San Francisco who said they liked politics with that San Francisco Giants picture and got a lot of views that way. We also used influencers who had big Twitter followings and who were San Francisco icons, so like Biz Stone, Marissa Mayer, Brian Wilson, the pitcher, people like that to tweet, and we sort of had a coordinated Twitter explosion that happened the day the video released. So we did that. We also targeted news outlets. It was a very newsworthy video, obviously, and we targeted a lot of San Francisco outlets. And then finally, we put a little bit of money towards like a media buy that was targeted towards San Franciscans. How they targeted towards San Francisco, I mean, it depends. There's a lot of different ways. I think the best media buys sort of diversify, but they'll use things like, you know, on your iPhone, you might have to watch a video before you can play a game, stuff like that.
Right.
So we got some views that way as well.
So mixture of paid and organic, I guess, in that,
exactly,
in that kind of thing there. So now where do you see things going next? You know, YouTube is dominant at the moment. There's certainly with the maker buy and a whole bunch of other things going on out there that there's definitely some movement in a direction towards maybe having some different options for people. But YouTube is pretty much the platform now, right? I mean, do you see anything else happening in the platform space that you guys are looking at that other creators should be considering?
Right now, I don't see that. I mean, from my point of view, when we make branded content and we're having conversations with our clients, it's all about YouTube. I mean, we're not talking about any other platform. And we're not talking about, you know, back in the past, like a couple of years ago, a strategy for videos was to release your video on every single platform.
Right, that's what I used to do, just tube
exactly.
Mogul and blast it out there.
Tube Mogul, right. Yeah. That's really not a strategy that our clients are using at all. They're looking at YouTube only. They want their video to be in one place. They want to get a ton of views. That's not to say that the future will be just like that. But I can tell you that the conversation that's happening right now, it's all about YouTube. And we, you know, what I can see and what we do occasionally is we do make pre-roll ads. Mm-hmm. And pre-roll ads are a separate art form. You know, you've got 15 seconds, basically. The first 5 seconds are incredibly important to keep someone from clicking off. Those pre-roll ads can go on other platforms, and we occasionally get approached for that. But no, it's mainly YouTube. I guess occasionally what you see also is they want us to make YouTube videos with the potential that it could go to TV. So a lot of times we cut our YouTube videos to 30 seconds or 60 seconds. Sort of the way we construct it is a lot like a TV commercial, but it's trying to do both things. It's trying to be shareable on the web, and if it's big enough, it'll go to television. So that's kind of where we are now.
So you have to really almost write it for almost two different lengths, right? A long-form YouTube version and a 30-second, or something where you can pull those 30-second clips out of to make a functional commercial as well. It must be pretty challenging writing that way.
Yeah, it is challenging. A lot of the stuff we do that has that sort of cross-platform stuff, that's our political work.
Right. A lot of it's still TV-based. And
a lot of it is TV-based. And what's fun about the political world is that sometimes the finely crafted television commercial isn't the best political ad. You almost want to make stuff that's strange, weird, that'll stick out. We released a political ad on YouTube that did fairly well, and then it was time to go to television. And NBC actually said, you can't put this on TV.
Really?
Because we were, in our ad, we were parodying Big Oil. And one of our characters, we said, was the CEO of, like, TransCanada. And we used his actual name. NBC said, sorry, you can't put this on. But that itself became a huge story.
Oh, I'm sure it did, right? Was that for a third-party organization, or was that for a candidate directly?
That was for a third party.
Yeah, that's usually what happens. So it's funny, the candidates can put anything they want up and they can't take it down at all. It's just the third parties, the stations have a little bit more leeway there, but that certainly has an impact.
Well, it's great because, you know, from a creator's point of view, you have to push as far as you can up to the edge, and if you go too far and you're not allowed to put it on television, it's still a win because it's a story, and if you have good PR...
Right, they'll go and watch it online.
There.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Excellent.
Exactly.
What's next, Super Bowl?
Super Bowl ad? Yeah. I mean, that would be amazing. Super Bowl is a great example of a place where the Super Bowl ad itself is newsworthy, right? Mm. I mean, you have a Super Bowl ad, that's a PR story. And so you can make an ad and it can go huge on the web on its own. It can get more views on the web than at the Super Bowl if you do it extremely, extremely well. So... that's a cool place, and we're not there yet, but one day.
Sky's the limit. I think you're on your way for sure, because the stuff is really, really high quality. So, Kai, do you mind sticking around for a few minutes so we can go through the news? I'm sure you may have some stuff to add in here. So, Tim, we'll go to our
YouTube. We do have a Super Bowl story.
We do have a Super Bowl story in there. In fact, it's part of our YouTube list of the week. And, Tim, we've got two things to look at this week. The first was that brand article in Adweek, which I'll pop up here. That shark on the Roomba was definitely a discovery plant and made the list at number three for the branding. PewDiePie is always doing well up there at number two. And it's funny that they were actually calling this a branded thing, because I don't know if he was working for anybody. But and then, of course, Naruto is up there at number one. What I found interesting was looking at the TubeFilter list for this week. So TubeFilter does the top 50 of the most viewed YouTube channels. And we come back to this list, every couple of weeks, just because it doesn't change that often. And one thing that kind of stuck out for me was, as a gadget reviewer myself, is this Disney Collector BR jumped up to number three with 24 million views this week. She's completely independent. And what she does is she looks at basically Disney toys that are just coming, into the toy store. She just doesn't even appear on camera. And she just reviews them, takes them out of the package, kind of handles them, and does her thing.
Well, you know what went on this last week in Anaheim?
No, what happened?
It was the big Disney convention for all the Disney fans.
Oh, so this is probably correlating.
Yeah. So I'm sure there was some tie in there that blew that up. So, folks like our buddy Lou Mangiello was down at the Anaheim Convention Center exhibiting, and he was doing his podcast down there, WDW Radio. So if you're a big Disney fan, you got to check out Lou's podcast. If you're a big Disney fan, you probably already know about Lou's podcast. It's a great one to check out.
I've got to get him on. But this is like one of those things that just always just amazes me that, you know, just something really simple that doesn't, I mean, what setup is there? There's a green floor and a yellow wall and somebody handling a toy, and it's just huge traffic. I guess parents find that pretty valuable. Kai, does anything ever surprise you? Like, does stuff like this surprise you, or is this something that you would expect to do well?
No, I'm constantly surprised. Always. I probably have like a moment of realization every 6 months with web video where I see something that's popular that I never thought would be popular. And it's just, I mean, some of the numbers are astounding with some of these channels. So, at this point I'm surprised, but I'm used to it.
And how do you adapt for that? Because obviously things change so quickly and your business depends on being kind of maybe at with that curve. So what do you do to try to make some of these things part of what you do? Or is it that your production value and production quality is different and it's a different type of audience?
Well, the exercise is finding out and learning about niche audiences, really, and finding out how big they are, right? So mm-hmm. One of the biggest realizations you can have when you're on the web and you're making content is that the internet is built into its niche audiences, but these niche audiences can be wildly huge, right? I mean, it's bigger than you can ever imagine.
Right.
So fans of collectibles can be so big that you can make something that can be worth millions and millions of dollars. You can make a property just based off people like that. So once you get that fundamental understanding down, then it's a matter of finding out what those niche audiences are. I'm not someone who says, I didn't come into the space knowing what all the niche audiences are. I still don't know what they are. I find out every day that, oh, there's another niche audience that wants content, and you could possibly work with a brand and target that niche audience. And then once you know that niche audience is out there, you try to figure out where is that niche audience located? Are they on a Facebook fan group? Or do they have their own website? A blog? Are they already on YouTube looking at certain channels? How can I partner with those partners? So that's where the strategy comes in. What we do, we spend a lot of time thinking about the niche audiences. We spend a lot of time trying to find the niche audiences. When we get a new brand coming to us, we think about what niche audiences are perfect for that brand. So we worked with Kimpton Hotels recently. A hotel chain. They have a wellness program. They were releasing yoga mats in every room. So we were looking for what niche audiences are going to want to watch a video by Kimpton Hotel. And we targeted a lot of people doing yoga. Mm. We targeted a lot of female business, females in business who are doing a lot of traveling websites. And then you find out where they are on the web. So that's kind of what we do.
It's pretty amazing. And yoga in particular, my neighbor right next door is a video guy too. And his wife owns a yoga studio, or it's actually a Pilates studio. And they do a lot of web video, and they're starting to see some real traffic on it too, which it's just amazing how much niches are out there. So, So Tim had talked about this on the outset of our YouTube segment here, and that is the Super Bowl playbook from Unruly Media. So this came across on one of those things that Tim gets every morning in his email there. So basically, we had that blackout that happened during the Super Bowl last year, and Unruly Media is kind of coming up with a guidebook for brands to be a little bit more agile when these opportunities occur. So as you all recall, Oreo started tweeting out like, hey, you know, it's a good time to go get another glass of milk or something. I think they actually did some creative, not only just tweets, but I think there was some creative involved with it too. So some opportunities there. If you go to Unruly Media, you can give them your email address and they will give you some feedback on what to do during the Super Bowl breaks or perhaps pauses in the game and whatnot. So that could be pretty fun. Tim, any thoughts about what people should be thinking about? Maybe even for creators to get some attention, right? Because there's a captive audience on Twitter.
Yeah, I think there is an opportunity for somebody to emerge out of nowhere if the timing's right. You know, it's an opportunity where you look at last year when the blackout happened, that was taken advantage of, but it could have been taken advantage of by somebody who no one had ever heard of before. So it's just being ready, being prepared for that right opportunity.
Didn't that whole what was it, that meme where everybody does the dance, I forgot the name of the song, the Harlem Shake, wasn't that, there was a Super Bowl connection there, like it was
they did take advantage of that. Kai, who was the was it Maker or the Collective that was seeding that?
I don't remember.
I think it was one of the MCNs was behind seeding Harlem Shake and getting that ball rolling.
Because that was kind of the genesis, was the Super Bowl blackout, that this thing was going around at that time, and it just kind of took off. And Kai, the brands that you work with, you know, they're smart enough to hire you because you are thinking differently. Do you often, and obviously you don't have to give us direct examples, but are you often finding yourselves doing a lot of consultation and education about, you know, being a little bit more risky, perhaps, or maybe being a little less conservative as to when to communicate and not testing things so often, given that there's very little cost in distribution? Is there something that brands should be doing around the Super Bowl and around events that occur that can give them the opportunity to speak more quickly?
Yeah, I think, timing is super important, of course. You know, it was interesting because it didn't necessarily come from brands. I remember we were part of Next New Networks back when, before they joined up with YouTube. And Next New Networks, one of their biggest values was actually they made the YouTube playbook before it was the YouTube playbook. And one of the most important things that they talked about was timing. And they were really great about it. They would communicate with their creators every single week. They would say, here are the big events of the week. This is the type of content you should make. This is what you should be thinking about. And so we've taken that into our, a couple years later, a few years later, we've taken that into our conversation with brands. So when we make a video, we think about what type of events are going to come up, what are people going to be looking at, and how can we position our video. And just for like an example of sort of how it can work, you know, we were thinking of making a video about a love story for a brand, and the brand really wanted to put it out on Valentine's Day, and they wanted to position it against some Valentine's Day content. And at first we thought that was a great idea. It sounded amazing. And then we looked at our content, we looked at our plan, and we realized that if we did that, our video would just get swallowed up. It would never be seen, because there was going to be a ton of other content coming out that same day with the same feel and tone. So in that sense, we actually made a decision not to put it out on Valentine's Day, to actually wait and, you know, separate our video. So you're making decisions like that. Sometimes it can seem like a good idea. Sometimes it's not a good idea.
And I guess you could often learn from what doesn't work for the future, unfortunately, right? It's tends to be how some things go. So Tim, also we have another story on here about some stuff that the Interactive Media Emmys. So I guess, is that a new segment, Tim, the Interactive Media Emmys? Is that?
No. It's something that's been going on for several years. But this year, one of our show guests and friend of ours, Bernie Sue, has won a Interactive Emmy for Lizzie Bennet Diaries.
Oh, yeah, look at that.
He gets to pick that up, I believe, on September 15th, maybe?
Interesting.
Something like that. Or 12th, September 12th.
Well, it's incredible. He's up there with some major names, right? I mean, this is a pretty big honor.
SpongeBob,
yeah.
Oprah.
Top Chef. I mean, these are all like, to be up at the same stage as Oprah on something is pretty pretty remarkable, especially for something, you know, all the other categories here really started in traditional media, and this is something that hasn't touched a television set, at least not one that's not hooked up to an Apple TV or something. So that's it's pretty remarkable. Pretty neat stuff. So moving on to movies, Tim, pretty slow week box office-wise. The World's End was number 5 at $8.5 million this weekend. That was it. That's the number 5, isn't it, $8.5 million? So you can imagine the rest of the movies didn't fare that well. Planes is number 4, but it's still doing pretty lousy at $8.7 million this weekend, $59 million overall. Mortal Instruments, its first week, sounds pretty gory. $14 million so far for its cume, $9 million this weekend. We're the Millers with Jennifer Aniston, $91.2 million. We talked about that movie before. And Lee Daniels, The Butler, is in at number 1 at $50 million, and this is week 2 for it. And there was a really neat article in The Wrap about, even though this has been the most successful summer for Hollywood dollar-wise, they're not all that happy about it because of the amount of money that they had to put in to get to that figure. That, you know, the margins are not as good because of the fact they're trying to find the next big franchise, and because everyone's trying to find the next big franchise, they're all putting a lot of money into things that really aren't sticking. And it was interesting in this article in The Wrap, if I can pull it up here, is that the like the kids' movies. There's just too many of them, right? There's just too many choices for parents. You got, you know, two Pixar movies, the Turbo, a whole bunch of other stuff. Really hasn't been doing that well. Tim, what do you think about Hollywood's woes here? What's the deal?
Well, it's death by a million cuts. I mean, there's so many things to do, and with the iPad and the iPhone, kids have entertainment all the time, so they're not clamoring to go to the movies. Also, particularly on this weekend, this is kind of back to school week, so there's a lot of kids going to school, and they aren't going to the movies. They're going shopping. They're buying backpacks. They're buying clothes, and they're going to school. And, you know, moms are and some dads are having to deal with all the challenges of carpools and you know, just all the rigmarole of what are they going to pack for lunch and those types of things. So not huge on box office. And then there's always YouTube on the iPad, which, you know, Disney's done research that says that, you know, if kids are consuming video, chances are it's on an Apple device, something I learned at a party. So, the only thing that I could think that, would make less sense is probably having Ben Affleck be Batman.
Yeah, right. Which is our other big story of the week, and I was waiting for Ben Affleck to be anointed the next Han Solo too, or something crazy like that. So,
that I could have digested a little bit better for some reason, because it just seemed like he was rebuilding his career, and he was heading to a place where he's a respected director, and then I don't know, to play Batman, it just doesn't. I don't see the brand permission. Kai, what do you think?
I mean, I see it from Ben Affleck's point of view as like a huge FU. Like, I'm back.
I got my Oscar, and now I'm going to do this thing, right?
Totally. This is like he's shooting for the moon, and he wants to have the greatest redemption story of all time, right? It's like, it wasn't enough to win an Oscar as a director. Now he's like, I'm going to be the biggest star I can be as well. So I respect it. I think he's setting himself up, if he succeeds, as this is going to be, you know, the greatest comeback of all time. But this is what he failed at before, so we shall see.
I have a feeling too that there's something to be said about lowering expectations and doing it on purpose, and this viral nature of how, I mean, certainly Ben Affleck playing Batman certainly has its deserved criticism, or deserved skepticism, I should say. But at the same time, you know, perhaps these things are being done in a way to lower that expectation bar, so that when people actually go to the movie, it's not as, you know, there's no high expectations coming into this film. There's pretty low expectations, and anything that looks good will rise above what people thought of it coming in. But I think of just this whole Ashton Kutcher and the Jobs movie, which apparently isn't that great of a movie, but I think it would probably have been panned worse if people weren't just destroying Ashton Kutcher for the last year as he's been working on this film. Tim, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I feel like this is one of those films that I've been hearing about, that it's going to be made, but I never heard that it was coming out. Like, for some reason, I knew it was coming out, but I didn't hear that it was coming out. It felt like they bailed on it early.
Right. And they roll it back, and they kind of redid it, and they had some work that they did on it.
Yeah. Yeah, to me it just mismanaged along the way, and obviously, you know, the timing was off. But you know, sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. It's like boxing. You got to be prepared. And
right.
I'd love to, if we have a little bit of time here, to talk to Kai a little bit more about White Collar Brawler and that journey as an independent content creator. And Kai, where's it headed to next?
So, it is actually heads for television. In October, it's going to be one of the first shows on Esquire television. Esquire magazine bought G4 TV.
Right.
Now they have their own channel. So it's going to be a show coming out in October called White Collar Brawler. Our web series was 24 episodes, followed me, my friend Nate, as we trained to box over 3 months. This is going to be, the show is going to be 6 episodes to start. Every episode is going to follow a new set of boxers, office workers who will fight each other. So it's really exciting. When we made the show, we were not necessarily trying to make something that would go to television, but we were trying to create a property, sort of a multifaceted property. We got an investor to help us out on the first season, and we told him, you know, we're not going to make money on a CPM. That's not our strategy for this. Our strategy is to make money in other ways. So, for example, you know, we sold a lot of tickets, 1,000 tickets to our final fight. We sold those tickets at about $25, $30 a pop. We also had VIP tickets for like 50-some dollars. So we made a lot of money that way. Then in creating a property, we were able to, you know, we had fans, we were selling T-shirts, et cetera. And now we, you know, we optioned it for television. We're now going to have a percentage of that production budget every time we make an episode. So that's there too. For us, it just never made sense to think about our show as something that could make revenue on the CPM. You know, when you go from zero, when you start at scratch, the idea that you can build a big enough audience quick enough to make money off of YouTube, to us, it seemed far-fetched at the time. I still think it's pretty far-fetched unless you have some influencers on your side in the show itself or some other thing up your sleeve. So you have to think about other ways to make your money. For us at the time, it was, hey, let's have live events. And then soon it became, we can take this to television. So now it's like, it's a nice ending to our story because I feel like we wanted to be a company that made cross-platform material. We really like the idea of making something on the web, getting it started there, and then having it go to television. And then hopefully one day come back to the web. So it's an important thing for us, an important step. I don't know how good the show will actually be. We'll see. We're making it with a company that's very good at making reality television shows. It's the same maker who did, same production house who did Toddlers and Tiaras and Honey Boo Boo.
That works.
So it's, yeah, that works. The show is going to definitely have a veneer of like reality television. So it'll be very interesting to see how it turns out.
I guess we don't want to give anything away if people are still in, you know, watching through this the web version of this. Who won? Or should people watch?
People should watch. People should watch. It built, I mean, you can just skip to the last episode if you want to look. But
right.
Yeah, it was interesting because you know, again, like you set up a story where you have two sides and our fan base picked sides. And so if you look in the comment section, you've got fans of Nate and fans of me and they're arguing with each other. And then, we, you know, when it came to like deciding what are the niche audiences that we're going to target, one of them was just local Bay Area people, because we were making this show in the Bay Area. So we were really trying to drive a lot of our press, a lot of our outreach towards people who lived in the Bay Area. So we had a lot of just local fans of the show. And when the final fight happened, 1,000 people showed up. They were wearing blue shirts for Kai, red shirts for Nate. People were talking smack. They were making bets. It was really, really cool. And, it felt like a professional boxing match, but it was two guys who had never boxed before. They had just learned how to box. So,
and this is your good friend that you're boxing here, right? Was that?
Yeah, it's my partner in at Port LA. I grew up with him. We went to kindergarten together. So yeah, big part of the show was just sort of two friends going to battle.
And how did that deal for your relationship during that period of time? Because obviously there were things you probably, you know, needed to keep close to the vest as far as strategy, and you're really going to go in and beat the crap out of each other. So what was it like? Did it change your relationship?
No, I don't think it did ultimately. If anything, it probably made us a little closer. But we weren't talking to each other for a while. We didn't want to trade secrets. It was weird. It was a weird experience because, you know, we were doing this thing, we were boxing, but we were also making a web show.
Right.
And when you mix making a web show in there, now it gets really crazy because
and competing, right?
We're having meetings about like how's the show going, what was the next episode have to look like. You know, I'm editing footage of myself getting my ass beat, stuff like that. I mean, it's just, there's so many layers of bizarre on top of it. When we came into the ring for the final fight, you know, you're about to have like a life-changing moment where you're about to fight your friend, But at the same time, you're looking around at the 1,000 people there, and you're like, wow, the web series is doing really well. This is great.
Always the businessman. That's important.
Right, and you're like, oh, you're looking at a camera guy on the side. You're like, is he positioned right? Like, is he going to get this? You know,
I can't imagine how exhausting this was, because it's one thing to fight. I mean, I've fought before, and it's another thing to make a web series. That's pretty tiring as well. I can't imagine doing them both at the same time.
I was just thinking about this, but it sort of. It's given me a perspective on sort of work and also being in this industry where I don't really put up with people who aren't going 100%, you know, aren't like giving it their all, because that's what you have to do to succeed, I think, in web video. You have to grind. You have to grind. And so I have been in a position where I've grinded so ridiculously hard, where, you know, I would spar on a Monday evening, get my face bloody, and then I would go home with an SD card of footage in my hand, and I would edit an episode that night and watch the footage of myself getting crushed, and I'd have to make decisions like, well, this is episode 12. By now, I should have worked on my jab a little bit, so I'm going to edit in shots of myself punching the guy, even though I got my ass beat. I'm going to make it kind of seem like I'm doing all right, you know, things like that. Then the episode, because we were releasing the show in real time, would come out the next day, and I would get it done at like 1 a.m., go to sleep, and then wake up at 7 a.m. for my morning jog, and, you know, it was just intensely crazy, incredibly tiring. But really, you know, really fulfilling. And so when I see people making web content, not that I expect them to be busting butt on that level, because that, you know, you don't have to make it torture like I did, but you do need to give it your all, I think. You do have to go 100%, or else you're probably not going to succeed.
I think that's very true. And the grind is really important to building audience over time. It just doesn't, like you said, it doesn't happen overnight to most people. It's like winning the lottery in many cases, that takes a lot of work to get there. And were you meeting with clients at the time, like coming in like just beat up in the morning? Did you have to explain to them, like, you know, walking into the big brand headquarters, that, you know, with a black eye or something? What was that like?
No, what we did was we decided, hey, for the next 3 months, this is what we're going to do.
Okay. Oh, so it was total focus on that. Got it.
total focus on that. So yeah, no, we gave it 100% on that.
Excellent. Well, Kai, thank you for joining us today. It's been great. Listening to all of the things you've been working on, it's just incredible. And before we go, Tim, we've got one thing, and we'll give Kai a good plug at the end here. There's a new app for YouTube. Did you see it this week?
Yeah, I was checking it out.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I'm gonna pull it up right here on camera two, because I got a camera two in here. So what you can do now is, while you're watching a video, of course, you can always go full screen with it. And this is a classic game room. This is another one of these guys you haven't heard about, but it's got a huge following. What you can do now is, apparently, it's not working right now, you can apparently swipe this thing off to the side and continue browsing YouTube while you're watching. Let me see if I can get this to work right here. There it goes. So now I've got it down at the lower end here. I can still continue watching the video, but I can also search for what I want to watch next also. And you have to stay in the app. It doesn't work in the background, but they've added some pretty cool new features to the YouTube app, making it really slick. I don't know if annotations are working yet, though, which has been our gripe, but hopefully that will come soon.
They tell me they can't do it.
Can't be done at all.
That's what they keep telling me.
Wow. Well, you heard it here first. So that's it. But that's the new YouTube app. And next week, Tim, I've got another cool drone-related app to show off. So we'll tease that off there. So, Kai, where can people find you on the internet?
So my company's website is portal-a.com. Take a look at our stuff. And my Twitter is @KaiHasson, KaiHasson.
And Tim, how about you?
@OneTimStreet on Twitter.
Find Tim there, and you can find me at Lon Seidman, LonSeidman. We record this show every Sunday morning at 11:30 a.m. Eastern Time, 8:30 Pacific. You can find us on our Google Plus community, which you can get to at behindthevideo.com. Also, Stitcher, iTunes, wherever you can find us, we'll probably be there. And if we're not there, let us know. We'll put ourselves there. So that'll do it for this edition of Behind the Video. We are a wrap.
Stories for this episode were compiled by producer Jason Perrier. Follow him on Twitter at JasonPerrier. Behind the Video is a production of Ape Digital Incorporated and the Independent Media Network, LLC. All rights reserved.